Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that we got going on over there. Exegetical, apologetics, theology, family style theology, regular style theology, all the styles of theology that happen to be Christ-centered existing over there. You can have podcasts about all that stuff. Also, we got city events coming up, guys. It is 2019, and the spring of 2019 is City Event Mania. On March the 9th, we will be in Austin, Texas. On May the 13th, we will be in Des Moines, Iowa. And on May the 4th, we will be in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's March, April, May, bam, bam, bam. If you're in any of those places, or in driving distance of any of those places, you should go to ChristOldFast.org, go to the events page, and check out the city event near you. We'd love to see you. Here's the thing about all the city events. All three of them, free. They're free. It costs you nothing. So all you have to do is show up, even though we would prefer that you register so that we know how many people are going to be there. But the registration costs you nothing. So just reserve your spot, and we'll see you at one of those events. Chad, what's going on?
Sitting here being happy that I've only got to drive like 45 minutes to the Austin event.
That's true. So me and Chad will both be at the Austin event. And Chad is just going to drive on over.
It's just like ride down the road. It's the first time I've actually driven to a Christ Old Fast event. It's nice.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that, you know, it's not likely that that's the case just because we put one in Texas, because not everything in Texas is driving distance.
This is true. Yeah. My parents live in Texas. Of course, it's an 8.5 hour drive away from me in the same state, but hey, yeah, we're all within the same border.
That's it. And, you know, I remember driving to Arizona, and I went down into Texas and then over, and I felt like I was driving through Texas for like 3/4 of the trip.
Yeah, it's like I like to tell everybody, I mean, one advantage is once I leave Texas, I know wherever I'm going, I'm 3/4 of the way there.
Yeah. As soon as you like cross into a new state, you're like, we're almost there.
I head to Minnesota, but since I get out of Texas, hey, I'm almost there.
Exactly. Well, so where we at in numbers here, man? We kind of left Balaam in a weird position.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we started this wild and crazy story about Balaam like last time, which begins in Numbers chapter 22, and we covered basically all of that chapter. This is another one of those cases where they got the chapter's division a few verses off. Chapter 23 really should begin at about verse 41 of chapter 22, but be that as it may, we're basically finished with chapter 22. So the first part, you kind of divide the whole Balaam story into two main sections. And we've covered the first main section. That's when he's hired, or they first attempt to hire him, and he rejects the proposal. And then they send, Balak sends messengers again. This time he says yes. And then we have the whole story of him and his donkey coming back, his donkey talking to him, so on and so forth. So that's all chapter 22. And that's kind of the first half of the story. Sets the stage for everything that is to come. And the second half of the story is chapters 23 and 24. And that second half of the story can be divided up into four main sections. And these are easy to figure out because there's four oracles or four pronouncements that Balaam makes in reference to Israel. And that covers chapter 23 and 24. And through each of these, you can kind of see an escalation arising of the kind of language, the kind of promises that are made until finally you get to the fourth of these. And all of a sudden, we have this amazing prophecy of this messianic star that will rise out of Jacob. We'll see how far we get for these four oracles. But let's go backwards here to the first one. And in the story itself, we have now had Balaam meet his, his employer, if you want to call him that, Balak. Balak is the king of Moab. He's hired. Balaam, who's this seer or prophet, to come and to curse Israel. To curse them, it seems in the story itself that the purpose of the cursing is to weaken Israel so that Moab will actually be able to conquer Israel. So, I mean, of course, there's different kinds of curses that are pronounced upon an individual or a people, but that seems to be the purpose, or at least the goal that Balak has in hiring Balaam, is that he wants him to curse Israel in such a way that the nation is weakened so that they will be able to conquer them. So you can kind of think of this as a sort of a spiritual sabotage that Balak wants Balaam to inflict upon Israel so that he'll be able to be victorious. So that's the plan. Now, Balaam has told him that he's only going to say what God tells him to say.
It seems as though Balak he doesn't really understand prophets very well, and what he's looking for is a sorcerer.
Yeah, I think that's really what's going on. We sort of have a discrepancy here between expectation and actual reality. Yeah, Balak is wanting to hire a sorcerer. He's wanting to hire someone who's going to be able to manipulate the omens or manipulate the gods so that they do what he wants them to do. And it might take more than once, as we'll see. But ultimately, that's really what he wants to happen. Instead of a prophet, of course, at least biblically speaking, is only going to be a mouthpiece of whatever God tells the prophet to say. So the prophet might speak to the present, it might speak to the future, but whatever he says really aren't his own words, but they're the words of the one that gives him those words.
Yeah, and old Balaam might have been low on the fear of the Lord going into this thing, but he has since had his tank refilled along the way, so it's probably not going to go well.
No, it's not. Yeah, whatever Balaam's original intentions were, or whatever his fear of the Lord level might have been, after having a donkey show him up, basically, in his visionary powers, the donkey was able to see what Balaam wasn't able to see, and the donkey spoke more truth than Balaam was speaking truth. So, yeah, you could definitely say that was a humbling experience for Balaam. So after, he's kind of put in his place, he's filled with the fear of the Lord. And so he actually says here in verse 38, we'll transition with this verse. He says to Balak, "The word that God puts in my mouth, that I shall speak." All right. So that's his promise. And we'll see how this works out. So here's what they do. It's all set up with a kind of ceremony that's involved. So they, the king, Balak, and Balaam, they go to this this place called Kiriath Huzot, and they have a sacrifice. So this sacrifice happens with the first three oracles, not the fourth, but the first three. So they sacrifice oxen and sheep at this place, and then in the morning, verse 41, Balak takes Balaam and he brings him to the high places of Baal. Baal, of course, being a very popular Canaanite deity that we'll hear a whole lot more about as the story of the Torah progresses. So they're on this high place, and from there they can see a portion of the Israelites camped down below. And Balaam gives some instructions first. He tells Balak to build seven altars and to prepare a sacrifice of seven bulls and seven rams. This is like the cream of the crop for sacrifices. This is like the most expensive sacrifice that you can offer with bulls and rams. And not only is it expensive, but because it's expensive, it's understood to be most efficacious. Now, the seven altars is interesting because we have a lot of sacrifices of seven, even in very legitimate instances in the Bible. I think, for instance, that At the end of Job, when he offers sacrifices for his friends, at the instruction of God, that that the number of seven is applied to those animals there. So the number is not unusual, but the seven altars is unusual. And I suspect what's going on here is that every altar is dedicated to a different deity. So you got seven altars and you got seven different gods or goddesses in view that are represented by each of these altars. Now, this might seem kind of weird to us, but it wouldn't have been weird for people during this time, because there were many peoples who did not restrict their worship to a single deity. In fact, monotheism was extremely rare. Set the Israelites apart was belief in the existence of one God. At best, people practiced what what was known as monolatry, or a belief that's referred to as henotheism. So henotheism is trust in one God, but not denial of the existence of other gods. And monolatry is worship of one God, but not denial of the legitimacy of worship of other gods. So polytheism is belief in many gods, and monolatry or henotheism is not the denial of the existence of other gods, but it's like, I'm just going to choose God A for myself, but I'm not saying there's not God B, C, D, all the way to Z. And that was pretty characteristic of the ancient world, where they might say, well, our gods are A, B, and C, but we know that other nations have gods D, E, and F. But the Israelites were very unique in that even though they did practice idolatry, at least officially, according to their own beliefs and scriptures, as it says in Deuteronomy, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And as the Ten Commandments say, you shall worship no other gods. So anyway, these seven, back to this reason I brought this up, these seven altars are probably dedicated to seven different deities, and they're just kind of, spreading their options out. Maybe if they involve more deities, then they'll have a better chance of actually being able to curse Israel.
Yeah, I'm trying to think now through, but whenever you have offerings made to God, these are single, even if you have multiple offerings, there's a single altar, which is
exactly,
which is representative of God being one. Even when Elijah will do battle with the prophets of Baal, like he creates an altar, and then they create an altar, and they go to work, right? They don't make multiple altars. It's just one. With the multiple gods thing, the weirdest thing is, and if you've ever dealt with someone like this, sometimes you'll deal with, someone who, Muslim, who, believes in Allah, and that's the God they believe in. And you can sort of have conversations. What's really weird is when you talk to maybe a Hindu or something who is sort of has their gods, but then you tell them about this other God and they're like, cool. Super weird. Like, they're that's great.
Yeah.
Like, oh, your God takes away sin? Right on. Like that sounds good to me. And it's a really weird thing when you're confronted with it, because you're like, no. And you end up feeling like a real jerk, because you're saying, no, I'm saying that's the only God. Like, all your gods are fake, and this is the only real deal. And he's like, well, I would never say that to you. And you feel like a real chump, well, that's really insulting. I would never tell you that your God wasn't real. That's what a rude thing to do.
Right, yeah, that's the scandal of particularity, right?
Yeah,
in Christianity. I mean, yeah, it's even more scandalous because not only do we affirm the non-existence of other gods, or the non-reality, I should say, of other gods, and the belief in one God, but we also say that this one God is the only means, the only way of salvation. Right.
Right.
So there's kind of a double scandal of particularity there in Christianity.
Yeah, but it's easy. It's easy. I mean, you can tell right from the jump that God is not exactly probably down with this whole thing, because God's not really into the being included in the pantheon of gods that are being sacrificed to.
Yeah, you can just kind of see him roll his eyes. Like he's going to be okay with the seven different altars dedicated to Baal and Asherah and whoever else they might have been dedicated to.
And yet it seems as though the God that Balaam expects to hear from is Yahweh.
That's kind of the strange. That's one of the. One of the odd characteristics of Balaam that we've already seen. I mean, he's not an Israelite, but he believes in Yahweh. He's not an Israelite prophet, and yet he is a prophet of some sort. And perhaps strangest of all, as we'll see at the end, he goes through all of this. He says all of these words of prophecy and blessing to Israel, and then he turns around. He's a complete underhanded jerk because he advises the Moabites on how they can actually trick the Israelites into engaging in idolatry. So, I mean, I don't know what to make of Balaam. He is a multifaceted character, that's for sure. So yeah, anyway, that's kind of the personality of Balaam. He's a very, very strange character in the scriptures. So back to the story, they have these sacrifices, and Balak does what Balaam tells him to do, offers up these bulls and rams, and Balaam then gives instructions to him and says, "All right, you stand here, you stand by the sacrifices, and I'm going to go over there." Wherever over there is, away from Balak anyway, and I'm going to see what God shows me or what God tells me. So he goes up to this bare hilltop. And verse 4 says that God met him there. God met Balaam, and Balaam begins in a very poor sort of way because he tells God, "I've set up the seven altars, and I've offered up a bull and a ram on each one." And I can just imagine God either saying or thinking to himself, "Yeah, well, that was a bad idea." But he goes on to give Balaam something to say. So, verse 5, the Lord, that is Yahweh, put a word in Balaam's mouth. And he says, "All right, go back to Balaam, to Balak, rather, and here's what I want you to say." So that's what he does. He goes back to where the king is standing beside the sacrifices. And beginning of verse 7, continuing through verse 10, we have the first oracle or the first proclamation of, I don't really like the word oracle because I don't know, that has that, to me, oracle has this connotation of a very non-Israelite approach to prophecy. So maybe I should just call each one of these a proclamation or a prophecy. So anyway, the first one is this. And it's poetic language. It's only four verses, so let me just read it to you. From Aram, Balak has brought me, Moab's king from the mountains of the east. Come curse Jacob for me, and come denounce Israel. How shall I curse whom God has not cursed? And how can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? As I see him from the top of the rocks, and I look at him from the hills, behold, a people who dwells apart and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his." So a very interesting first of these proclamations. It's more or less attributing great power and numbers and potential to Israel. So it begins by basically saying in very poetic language that he's been hired by Balak to come and to curse Jacob. And then he says, "That's not within my power because I can't curse someone that God hasn't cursed. I can't denounce someone that the Lord has not denounced." So from the very beginning, this enterprise of Balak is set up for failure because Balaam is not going to be able to do what is contrary to God. He can't speak that which is contrary to God's words.
Well, I definitely feel like God at this point is like, "Yeah, I'll give you something to say." The fact that God said, "Yeah, you go ahead," this is I you know, we talked last week about this being a comedy. I do think that you do see the sense of humor of God, where he's like, "No, you go ahead and go, and then you say what I tell you to say," and then of course what he tells him to say is the opposite of what this guy wants to hear. which I feel like God is just getting a kick out of.
Yeah.
Like, he's just poking at this guy.
Psalm 2, he who sits in the heavens laughs, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's like, I'll give you a little, like, he's going to, like, bless them and all that. He's going to, it's pretty funny.
It is. Yeah.
Like, this king is all like, all right, like, it's a bloody mess. They've sacrificed all these things. And he's like, all right, here we go. Here come the curses. and it just doesn't happen.
No. And you can see the anger and the frustration of, because verse 11, the first words out of his mouth are, what have you done to me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I hired you. I took you to curse my enemies. And behold, you have actually blessed them. And then Balaam responds basically by saying the same thing that he's told him a couple of times now. He says, must I not be careful to speak what Yahweh puts in my mouth? And this is this response of Balak. Of course, his anger is to be expected, but man, he doesn't know what's coming. So far, Balaam has, yeah, I mean, there's some very positive language in here about Israel. You know, they're who can count the dust of Jacob. That's just like the blessing to Abraham, right? Your seed shall be like the sand on the seashore, like the stars in the sky. And he even ends by saying, hey, let my death be like his. You know, if I'm going to die, let me die like an Israelite. So yeah, he says a lot of good things, and certainly he doesn't curse Israel. And so Balak is understandably mad about this, but oh man, if he only knew what was coming, he would have fired him on the spot. And instead of letting him go on for three more times. So anyway, that's the first one. So, because that one did not go as planned, Balak decides, well, let's change locations. Let's try this in a different place, and you can curse them for me in that location. So this kind of gets to the theology of Balak. So in the theology of Balak, if you keep trying enough times, you can eventually manipulate God into doing what you want him to do. So we're going to try A didn't work, so we're going to try B. We're going to try a different location, a little bit different vantage point, and this time maybe God will do what we want him to do. So this is a characteristic of those who believe in sorcery or magic or omens or any of that kind of thing, that if you try enough, if you keep going, then eventually you're going to get the answer that you want. We actually have instances of this recorded in some of the Greek histories and Hittite manuscripts as well, where someone tried for like 3 days casting arrows until finally they got the answer that they were looking for. So I suspect that that's kind of the theology that's behind Balak's insistence that they try another spot.
Yeah, so you're shaking that magic eight ball four times.
Yeah, we're going to throw the dice all day until we finally get the ones that we want.
Well, what's interesting too is they go to this other spot and they do this whole sacrifice thing all over again.
Yeah, it's like it didn't work the first time. Well, make sure it's going to work this time. So, yeah, that's what they do. I mean, they go to this. It's called the Field of Zophim, to the top of Pisgah, which we've heard about before. Same thing. They build seven different altars. They offer bulls and rams on each altar. And same instructions. Balaam tells the king to stay there, and I'm going to go there and see what the Lord tells me. Same repetition of events. God meets Balaam. He puts a word in the mouth of Balaam, and he goes back in order to relay this word to the king. So he goes back, verse 17. The king is standing there with the leaders of Moab. And now this is interesting. Because you would expect Balak to say something like, what has the oracle told you? Or even what has God said to you? But notice the language that he uses. He says, what has Yahweh spoken? Very interesting. This is the first time that the divine name is found in the mouth of this Moabite king. So you can kind of see, as the story goes on, Balak coming around to the realization that Yahweh is a true God. Yahweh is the God of Israel, and Yahweh is the one who's speaking to Balaam to relay back to the king. So in this particular proclamation, which begins in verse 18 and goes all the way through verse 24, There's a heightening of the language that's used. And now it starts out in a very interesting way. Verse 19 says this: God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and he will not do it? Or has he spoken, and he will not make it good? So this is God's way through Balaam of telling Balak basically, hey, listen, all of this is for nothing, because I'm not like a person. I'm like a human being who can be manipulated. Or, you know, if you want to change somebody's mind, you keep coming back and you keep coming back and you keep coming back, and you hope that you catch them in a moment of weakness and they change their mind, or they're just going to be fickle and they'll actually go with what you have to say. Or they'll say one thing and then they'll eventually change their mind and say another thing, or they'll tell the truth and then they'll tell a lie, or they'll tell a lie and then tell the truth. And God says, listen, I'm not like that. I'm always truthful and I'm always faithful. And the word that I've spoken is the word that's going to come true.
Yeah, I mean, so in some translations you'll have like, I'm not a man that I should repent, right? Or change my mind, right? It's like, I'm not going to change my mind. What is interesting is that we actually do have examples, and we've looked at some of them, where God does have his mind changed. But what's different about it is that when God does change his mind, he changes his mind when somebody appeals to his mercy. You don't see these instances where God changes his mind, where someone's like, well, I know you were going to be merciful, could you be wrathful instead? Or I know you delivered this blessing, can you deliver a curse instead? That's not a thing. The only time that God relents or changes his mind or doesn't do what he said he was going to do is when somebody says, yeah, but what about your mercy? Which is the opposite of what they're trying to get to happen here. They're saying, hey, how about you like renege on all the promises you've made to Israel and you don't bless them? And God's saying, look, this just isn't going to happen.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, the classic case of that is Jonah, right? Where God relents from the evil that he had threatened against the city. Now, what's also interesting in that particular example is Jonah is kind of like Balak here, right?
Yeah.
Except Jonah is wanting God to curse the city of Nineveh, and Balak is wanting God to curse the Israelites. But either way, the human being who desires punishment and cursing doesn't get his way, because God has decided to bless. And so the context is extremely important, especially here, because God goes on to say that when he's blessed, he's not going to revoke the blessing. So he's chosen Israel. They are his people. He's blessed them. And he's not going to renege on that particular promise. He's not going to turn around and curse them now that he's blessed them. And then he goes on to talk about we have this language taken from the animal kingdom of the power of Israel. Verse 22 says that God brought them out of Egypt, and he is for them like the horns of the wild ox. And then verse 24, he says, a people rises like a lioness, and as a lion, it lifts itself, and it shall not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. And so in these images that are taken from lions and from wild oxen, we have divine power, and we have also divine power given to Israel. So they're the ones that are blessed by God in such a way that they will be able to conquer their enemies, which, of course, is the diametric opposite of what Balak desires, because he's already afraid. He's already seen Israel conquer these other kingdoms, and that's why he hired Balaam, was so that he wouldn't be conquered. And now his prophet is turning around and saying, oh yeah, these people you hired me to curse, they're strong, they're powerful, they're going to kick everybody's butt, because they have the horns of the wild oxen, and they're like this lion that's ripping everything into shreds and licking the blood of the slain. And you can just see Balak standing there, and his face is getting red, and he's stomping the ground, and He's really mad now, because Balaam has done once more the exact opposite of what he wanted to do. So anyway, that's the end of the second proclamation. Now, this next one starts out And Balak is, you can tell he's getting worn down. Because listen to what he says. This is verse 27. He says, please come. I'm going to take you to another place, and perhaps it will be agreeable with God that you curse them for me from there. which is just comic, because you can tell that he's lost all confidence. He knows that this is all going to fail. But he's like grasping at straws. Maybe, just maybe, you know, we'll catch God in a moment of weakness, and he'll be happy to actually do what I want and curse Israel from this particular location.
Yeah, it's so weird that he thinks the location is the problem here. Well, at least, yeah. or potentially the problem. Like, neither of these spots, those two spots didn't work. And like, I don't think this
is the wrong place.
Yeah, I don't think this has anything to do with the place, dude. Like,
yeah, he's pinpointing the wrong problem here. He's pointing at all these other locations. He should be pointing back at himself, because he's the problem. So they go to the top of Peor, same repetition of events. They build seven altars. They offer the sacrifices. And but one thing changes here. Now we're at the beginning of chapter 24, verse 1. When Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he did not go, as at other times, to seek omens, but he set his face toward the wilderness. Now, this is one of these characteristics of narrative where sometimes we're told something later in the story that impacts the earlier part of the story. And I think this is one of those cases, because we're not told that at those other times that Balaam went out and sought omens, but I guess he was in some way. He was using some of his pagan practices, but this time it says he did not. So evidently he did before. This time he just looks toward the wilderness, and he lifts up his eyes, and he sees Israel camping out below, tribe by tribe, and the Spirit of God came upon him. Now this is fascinating. So you got this prophet, not from Israel, who's been hired to curse Israel, and so far all he's done is bless them. And it's already kind of a strange, unexpected theology that's going on here. And it gets even stranger, because now the Spirit of God comes upon him, just like the Spirit of God descends upon the Israelite prophets. And he takes up his discourse, and here's what he says. This time, the language is even more different, even more elevated than what we saw before, because now he describes himself as the one whose eye has been opened, whose eyes are uncovered. So it's like he really begins to see now. And he begins with pronouncing, he says, upon Jacob, he says, how fair are your tents, your dwellings, O Israel. That still is used, by the way, as the opening verse of a prayer by Jews as they enter into the synagogue. So it's the only Jewish prayer authored by a non-Jew that still uses synagogue services today. That's verse 5. How fair are your tents, O Jacob? So this is how Balaam begins praising the beauty and the power and the expansiveness of Israel. And then he goes on in verse 6 to talk about how they are all these similes that he uses. There's a lot of like valleys that stretch out. They're like river gardens. They're like aloes and cedars that are beside the waters. And then he gets to verse 7 and he picks it up even more. He says that Israel's king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. God brings him out of Egypt. He's for him like the horns of the wild oxen. He's going to devour nations and crush their bones and shatter them with his arrows. And then verse 9, which is where this particular proclamation ends, he compares him to a lion. And he's borrowing language. This is fascinating. He's borrowing language of verse 9 from Jacob's blessing of his sons, because this is the exact language in verse 9 that Jacob uses to bless Judah way back in Genesis. He talks about how Judah is a lion, and as he lies down, who dares to rouse him? So we got this blessing of the tribe of Judah, and Balaam's now blessing of all of Israel, using the metaphor of a lion and its power and its menacing strength its ability to conquer its foes. This particular oracle, this particular proclamation, is looking not just at Israel as they are now, but he's looking out even further. He's looking into the distant future when Israel is going to have a king, and that kingdom, the kingdom of that king will be exalted, will be lifted up, and even to the point to where this king is going to be like a lion who is unconquerable, who is the king of the creatures, and he's going to destroy his enemies and be feared. And when I read this, especially in light of the next proclamation, which I don't know that we'll get to today, but I think already here Balaam is looking beyond even the distant future to he's looking all the way to the messianic future, because that is when the kingdom will be truly exalted, and that king will be higher than any other king, and he's going to be from the tribe of Judah. That's the tribe from whence the Messiah comes. And he is going to be that lion of the tribe of Judah that Revelation talks about, who is the conqueror, who is the ultimate victor, who is the one who reigns triumphantly over all his enemies because he's triumphed over them all in his cross and resurrection.
I like at the end too, where if this isn't a dig by God, I don't know what is, but when he says, he ends with, "Blessed are those who bless you and cursed are those who curse you," which is just a huge backhand to Balak.
Yeah. This is where everything very explicitly backfires into Balak's face. I mean, it's already been clear that his goal here has been undermined by the divine will, but here it's thrown right back in his face. But, because the one who tries to curse Israel is himself cursed.
Yeah, I mean, it says that his anger was kindled against Balaam, and he struck his hands together, which I don't even know what that means, other than it just, like, so frustrated, he's just smacking his hands together.
Yeah.
Freaking out.
Yeah. Right, or like, you know, we punch make a fist and punch one hand because we're so angry, right? We need to hit something. And yeah, I mean, at this point, basically, he fires him. He tells him in verse 11, just go back where you came from, because that you didn't do what I hired you to do. In fact, you did the exact opposite.
Well, this is interesting that he says there too. He says, "You'll go to your own place. I said I would honor you, but the Lord has held you back from honor." Now, I think what this implies is that he was going to honor him in the way of give him something.
Yeah, he was going to write him a big fat paycheck, right?
Yeah, like there's something going to go down. And he said, "Hey, this God of yours, he really gave you the shaft because I was going to really hook you up, and now I'm not," which I think does play into what we see happen at the end, like, because I do think that Balaam is of a divided mind. He's only going to speak the thing. He's too afraid. I mean, you got an angel with a sword, like, no amount of honor. He's like, "Well, I can't say the thing." And God expressly said, "Only say what I tell you to say." So he's like, I gotta do that. But maybe there's a way that I could get honored and still not technically not do what God said to do. And we're going to have to get to that next week.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. We'll finish up chapter 24, the whole Balaam story, and then we'll get to chapter 25 next time.
All right. Well, Chad, people should come out to the city events. If they're in any of those areas, go check it out. We'd love to hang out with you. Chad, I'll hang out with you next week.
All right, man. See you then.